for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. is known as a nation of immigrants. Their contributions over centuries have helped build the strong and culturally rich country we have today. But as debate over immigration reform legislation heats up, so has anti-immigrant rhetoric. In a new book, journalist and author Alvaro Vargas Llosa examines the causes and consequences of human migration. He argues that immigrants' contributions far outweigh the costs. His book is titled Global Crossings. Alvaro Vargas Llosa joins me in the studio. I know many of you will want to join our conversation. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. You know, I think there was a time when, as you point out in your book, there was a time we all thought of ourselves as a nation of immigrants, and we were proud thereof. Do you think we're moving away from that notion?
I think we have to an extent, but I think it would also be interesting for listeners to know that back then, talking about the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, although there was a positive feeling about immigrants throughout part of the nation, there was also a lot of hostility.
Of course.
Yeah. So it's never been easy for immigrants, and this debate has never been won by one side easily. There were a lot of prejudices against Irish immigrants in the 19th century, against Italian immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Of course, Jewish immigration as well from Central and Eastern Europe faced a lot of that, not to speak of Japanese. And so it's always been tough. But yes, there have been periods when the climate was a more friendly climate than the one we've had recently. Obviously, the economy, 9/11, all of that has not helped at all.
And certainly you come at a time when the Congress of the United States is really in heavy debate about this issue. What would you most like them to understand?
The important thing is not only to take care of the immediate problem, the problem we face now, but to anticipate the future intelligently. Previous attempts at reform were relatively good at taking care of the immediate problem, bringing people out of the shadows back then, but were not as good at anticipating what was going to happen in the future, which is why we ended up facing exactly the same problem a few years down the line. So how do we prevent another 11.5 or 12 million people 10, 15, 20 years from today from having, you know, again, sort of triggering a debate about how to take care of them and how to bring them out of the shadows again? And I think one way to do that is not to pretend you can really know for sure exactly the number of immigrants from different categories, from high skill to low skill and whatever else you want to categorize them as, how many exactly are going to be needed by the economy and by society. And that's the only part of this that I think is people who are pro-immigration are not necessarily all that clear about.
But hasn't that always been the case that when immigrants came to this country, they brought with them perhaps their own skills, their own ability to blend into the workplace? What's different now?
It's very interesting because, I mean, there are differences, but the really striking point here is, or the striking feature of this, is really that the similarities far outweigh the differences. Assimilation, for instance, is taking place pretty much at the same pace that it did in the early 20th century. It's a three-generation process. The first generation makes some progress. The second generation fits in very well. And by the third generation, assimilation is complete to such an extent that they don't even speak the mother tongue, the language that their parents or grandparents used to speak.
But is that true now?
Yes, absolutely. It's true. Not only that, let me just give you one little example.
Sure.
For instance, out marriage, what they call out marriage, in other words, marrying beyond your national community. Second generation Italians in the early 20th century, they were out marrying at a certain pace. In the second generation, it was 17% of them. They married non-Italians. Today, among Mexicans and Hispanics in general, it's almost 20%. So it's similar to what it was back then. And yet, there are, of course, a lot more proportionally, relatively speaking, there are a lot more Mexicans today than there were Italians back then in terms of what percentage of the population they constitute and what percentage of immigrants in general they constitute. So arguably, it's easier for a Mexican today to marry another Mexican in the U.S. than it was for an Italian back then. And yet they're out marrying at exactly the same pace. In fact, even more.
But as you say, there are more of them coming in. So you hear complaints, for example, people who live in Florida who might argue, when I go into a shop, all I hear is their native tongue. I don't hear as many of them attempting to learn, quote, our language.
I can fully understand that impression. And yet, if you look at all the research, all the statistics, the evidence points in a different direction. By the second generation Hispanics, in this case, let's talk about Hispanics because they're the most numerous ones, are speaking English better than they're speaking Spanish. And by the third generation, they're not speaking Spanish anymore. Not only that, if you look at past waves of immigrants, it was very similar. Italians would go to certain communities, they would speak in Italian. Germans would go to certain communities in the Midwest and they would speak German. Not only that, they would print newspapers in German, just as some Asians did in California back then and even more recently. It's very common for immigrant communities, at least in the first generation, to sort of protect themselves in this fashion. And yet that is not an obstacle for assimilation and integration. And anyway, it's still happening at the same pace that it was before.
There seems to be a difference now in the sense that we've already been told that within 20 years, Hispanics, Japanese, Italians, people of all different races, ethnicities will be in the majority. The white population will be in the minority. Doesn't that change the attitude of people who are here now, who see this influx and who realize that they will eventually?
Oh, it's human nature that it should. I mean, clearly, people are always going to be feeling a little bit, threatened by an influx of people who are going to change the demographics of their community or even their color. You know, it's the way human nature tends to react. And yet, I would point that it's always been like that in the United States. You had an original wave of immigrants, and then you had a different type of immigration, and that changed the demographics. And so if you look at what happened between the 1830s and the 1880s, it was mostly Western Europeans and heavily Anglo-Saxon and Northern Europe. And yet between 1880 and 1920, it was all Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans. Very different people culturally, and they looked different as well than the previous waves. And those people who had come in earlier, of course, felt exactly the same. The demographics are going to change. We're going to feel that we're not in the majority anymore. And that is true. But I mean, that was not the end of the world. That enriched U.S. society, that made it even more prosperous, made it more dynamic. And I think this is what's going to happen today. I mean, it's not doomsday that this is country becoming more diverse. I think it's something that white Americans should embrace and live with happily.
Alvaro Vargas Llosa, his new book is titled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. You can join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow at WAMU.org. You also argue that legal immigration helps the host nation as well as helping the newly arrived immigrants. What do you mean?
Well, immigration in general tends to have a very positive effect, both economically, because it helps to enlarge the economy and it helps to create a lot of dynamics, both at the lower end and the high end of the economic scale, as it were. But it also helps culturally. We live in a world that's interdependent, that's globalized, where you want to be connected to the rest of the world. And if you have communities of people here who have these attachments to the rest of the world, clearly it's going to be helpful. One, I think, tremendous example of this is the Chinese community, which was for a long time in this country looked at with a lot of suspicion. But in the last few decades, part of the great economic exchange between the United States and China has been facilitated by the fact that there were Chinese Americans who understood China, who knew China, who were accepted as interlocutors in China, commercially and otherwise, and who established bridges between this country and China. Now, forget about government for a moment, just societies, just the dynamics of traveling back and forth, exchanges, cultural, and of course, economic as well. So I think it helps the country in many ways. It helps culturally. It helps from a point of view of, I mean, economically, clearly economically as well.
Alvaro Vargas Llosa, he's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. His new book is titled Global Crossings. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, talk further and include your comments. Welcome back. If you've just joined me, Alvaro Vargas Llosa is with me. His new book is titled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. And so far, Alvaro, we've been talking about those who came to this country legally, who brought with them their own cultures, began to assimilate, began to learn the language, helped to enrich our society. Now the debate has to turn to the illegal immigrants who are here in this country and who have become the focus of not only congressional attention, but the public feels very, very divided on this issue. How do you differentiate in your own mind between those who come here legally and those who come here illegally?
This is a great point, Diane, and I think it's a really legitimate issue, of course, to debate and discuss. I mean, who wants to have millions of people operating in the shadows, and especially not a country that prides itself on operating and being governed by the rule of law? No? But here's the difference. We talk about these immigrants in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, And they numbered proportionally about the same as they do today in terms of what percentage of the population. We're talking about 13, 14, 15% of the population is about 13 today. So the numbers are not really all that different. The difference was that there were much fewer restrictions. There were no ceilings or quotas, and therefore they could come in legally. Now the difference is we have quotas and ceilings that make it very hard for the supply to match the demand, as it were. In other words, in times of bonanza, say the 1990s, there was a lot of economic activity, a lot of demand for foreign workers, and yet there was a ceiling, so there were only so many that could come through legal channels. So eventually what happened was they found a way around the law, which is why I think the really important issue here is not only, of course, that we want everybody to come in legally. I mean, clearly, who doesn't want that? The issue is here, how do we have a system? How do we put in place a system that's flexible enough to accommodate the demand for workers and the supply for workers, depending on what time of the economic cycle we find ourselves in, for instance? Because those things are going to change from year to year. I mean, 3 years from now the economy obviously is slow, but 3 years from now, 4 years from now, who knows? We might have a booming economy. We might need not 200,000, but 500,000 immigrants. And if the law doesn't adapt itself to that reality, then we get a situation in which the black market thrives. In other words, we get illegal immigrants.
But what about the question of skill sets? And who comes into this country? There are a great many people who believe the illegal immigrants are taking from this country rather than giving to it. You say in your book that people fear, well, we know that people fear that illegal immigrants are taking jobs from people here in this country because they're willing to take low pay, below minimum wage. You've got that problem as well.
Well, I conducted very extensive research on this, Diane. What I found is the following. They don't take jobs away from Americans. Let me just give you one example. Just before the bursting of the bubble, in other words, just before the crisis in 2007, you had in Arizona a very interesting situation. You had almost full employment. Unemployment was only about 4%, and yet 10% of the workforce was immigrant. So clearly immigrants were not taking jobs away because there was almost no unemployment at all. Or look at it this way. From the Second World War to until today, in other words, you know, over what 60 years or so, we've had millions and millions of baby boomers and women join the workforce. About 90 million, if you combine the two. And yet there's never been long-term unemployment in the United States. This huge influx of new workers, what they did is, of course, they enlarged the economy. They grew the pie, as it were, which is exactly what happens with immigrants. Now, in terms of wages, yes, there is a very small impact at the lower end temporarily. Our research indicates that they lower wages at the lower, at the bottom of the scale by about 1.5%. Which is offset by the fact that those who move up the scale because of this dynamic earn higher wages. And the effect, the net effect, is about 1.8% rise in salaries. So really there's no negative economic effect. It's really very positive. But I know this myth is very entrenched, and this is an argument that
you
people make.
You hear it all the time. Where were you born, Alvaro?
I was born in Peru.
And came to this country when?
Well, I came about 10 years ago. I was invited to write a book about Latin America. I was based for a while in the other coast. And then that was so far away from all the places I need to travel to that I thought, well, I better move to the East Coast. And I never thought I'd be here for such a long time. And here I am.
You are the son of Mario Vargas Llosa, whom I have had the honor of interviewing. He wrote fiction. He also ran for president of your country at one point.
That is correct, yes.
How is he?
He's very well. He's still writing. He's not as young as he was, but he's still going and still strong. And he spends his time mostly in Europe and spends a few months a year in Peru as well.
Have you become an American citizen?
No, I am a resident. My children, I have a son who's 17 and a daughter who's 14. They're both American citizens.
Because they were born here.
One of them was born, my son was born in London, and my daughter was born here.
Now, does your son have dual citizenship?
Yes, yes. Peruvian and American, and so does my daughter.
Here is a two-part tweet. He says, I'm on an H-1B visa. I have a STEM master's. What does that mean, a STEM master's?
No idea. I
have no idea.
I know what a master's is, and I know what an H-1B visa is.
And I have been waiting for a green card for 10 years. I want to begin a startup, but can't. I'm forced to move to Canada for a startup visa. Our focus on immigration is so skewed against productive immigration.
I'm very surprised because that person, I don't know if it's a he or a she, but sounds very much like somebody who should not have a lot of trouble getting a green card. Why? Because the way it usually works is this. An H-1B visa, for those listeners who don't know, is a visa that you get when you're sponsored by a company or an organization. I was once on an H-1B visa as well. You get it for 3 years, and it's renewable only once for another 3 years. After that, if you want to remain in the country, you need to apply for a green card. If the company or organization to which you are attached sponsors you, usually you should not have much trouble getting that one. So I'm surprised that person is getting it. Alternatively, because that person mentioned as well they want to establish a startup, that's another way of doing it. There's a type of visa that you can obtain if you can invest a certain amount of money and create, I think it's 10 jobs. So if that person has some capital or is able to get a loan, that person should not have a lot of trouble, unless something else is happening that we don't know about.
Here's an email from Laurel in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who says, no country in the world is foolish enough to have open borders because it would be suicidal. We have an immigration system through which people from other countries become citizens every day. Someone who does not respect our laws enough to go through our system legally does not deserve to be here.
Oh, that's a very powerful sentiment and a very legitimate sentiment. I mean, who can be against the idea that everything should take place under the law? I mean, clearly you don't want millions of people operating outside of the law, just as a matter of principle, I mean, let alone the consequences. But I go back to a point I made a while ago, which is the fact that if the law does not reflect reality, what tends to happen is conditions are created for a black market. This happens with trades, with goods, with services, and also with humans. It's just the way it works. If the law is kind of disconnected from reality, you tend to have a situation in which demand is so strong that it will push people on the supply side to find ways around the law.
How do you believe our laws are disconnected from reality?
Well, I think that we have had for a long time restrictions in terms of ceilings and quotas that were not realistic. Just to give you one example, we were talking about H-1B visas just now, and it's a perfect example. Before the bursting of the bubble, now we have, everything that went on before and everything that went on after the bursting of the bubble, but we're talking about 2006, 2007. You had a ceiling of, I think it was 65,000 H-1B visas. Look, that quota, Diane, was exhausted on the first day when you were able to apply. So can you imagine? This was a number that was really established so that people throughout the year would be able to apply for an H-1B visa.
It was exhausted
and on day one, it would be exhausted. Clearly, that was not realistic. So, you know, that creates an incentive for if there is demand for those types of workers, and we're talking about sort of mid to high skill in this case, creates incentives for people to find ways around the law. And we have the same situation, for instance, in this bill under discussion in the Senate. There's one category called so-called W visas. That's really low skilled. The number they have established for the first year, it kind of rises as time goes on. But for the first year, is 20,000, which I really think, Diane, is very unrealistic. I mean, clearly we need more than 20,000. There's demand for more than 20,000.
To do what?
For low-skill jobs.
To what kind of low-skill
jobs? Oh, construction, for instance. You know, we're talking. There's a special provision for agriculture workers, but we're talking about sort of the equivalent in various industries. Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody is able to anticipate the future in this precise way. But I am pretty certain that there is demand for more than 20,000 at that level. So again, if the demand for them is much higher than 20,000, you will definitely get a situation in which people will try to find ways around the law.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. We'll open the phones first to St. Augustine, Florida. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, good morning, Diane.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
First of all, the STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. It's
good.
A focus that the federal government is having for degrees in high school and in college.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome. I'm a seven-generation Southerner. My family immigrated here in the 1740s into South Carolina, and all the paternal limbs of my family have been in the South. I'm in my 60s, and so I've been through segregation and integration of our high schools, and that assimilation is taking a long time, but it is happening, and my best friend happens to be an Afro-American man. I'm a WASP. And I think that's slow, but it's productive, it's positive, and it's happening. And, of course, Spanish speakers in Florida are being assimilated as well, and it's comfortably. It just takes time. But the point I want to make, too, was that my son lives in New Orleans, and I visit there often, and how they've embraced the French culture that settled that area, and that actually the French language is quite quaint and acceptable now because of the time. And I just think that all these things are going to take a long period of time to happen, and they will be accepted. Whether we are the minority or the majority, America will be America.
Alvaro.
Fascinating. Absolutely,
yes,
fascinating. Well, I mean, that's what my research indicates, and it's always wonderful when real life, the real world, matches your research. That's exactly what I'm finding. It does take a bit of time, but it always took a bit of time, and it is happening. The listener mentioned New Orleans, and it's very interesting. Not only French culture, at one point, Cuban culture was very much part of that heritage. Of course, they've now moved to Florida, and we all know, we're all very much aware of that, but at one point, Cubans were settling in New Orleans, and there was a time, and I've read testimonies of the times, Spanish was spoken there for a while. And then, of course, things evolved, and now Spanish is not really spoken all that much. There are a few pockets here and there. And yes, I was aware that in certain communities, French is still very much alive.
Thanks for calling, Jim, to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning. Thank you. I just want to say that this is a very interesting talk. I'm a fourth-generation Mexican, and I was really interested in what Alvaro had to say about language being lost. My grandmother and my mother grew up in East L.A., and they weren't allowed to speak Spanish growing up because they wanted to be Americanized, and that assimilation was really pushed there. And my grandmother dealt with so much racism that it was very important for her that her daughters be seen as Americans. So culturally speaking, for me, I'm a 30-year-old young adult, and now being bilingual is very essential, especially in the work field. And I feel like it's something that I lost as part of my culture. And I just think that's very interesting, your point about it being lost by the third generation.
Interesting.
She makes a very, very interesting point. Not only is that right, that's exactly what's happening, not only in her case, it's happening across the country. But she mentioned something I would like to quickly touch upon, which is Americanization. I don't know if listeners are aware of this. There was a time, and we're talking about the early part of the 20th century, when Americanization was very much part of the deal. And that meant it was not so much government policy. It was a general attitude, a general social and cultural attitude that kind of pushed, and I use this hesitantly, this word, because it really wasn't pushing. It was just encouraging in terms of the general climate, immigrants to learn English and Americanize. And I think there was something to be said for that. And it's true that there was a very positive aspect to that in the terms that everywhere, in school, at the corporations, everywhere, there was this incentive for people to integrate and assimilate. That was lost beginning in the 1960s, probably in part because of multiculturalism, the idea that it was just not fair to be pushy on minorities and so on. But I think you can get a fair balance between the two.
Alvaro Vargas Llosa, his new book is titled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Short break, more of your calls, comments when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
The comic trio The Lonely Island has a new album, their third, with guest appearances by Lady Gaga and Justin Timberlake. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andy Samberg and the guys behind The Lonely Island, who made music parodies on Saturday Night Live. Join us. I got that diaper money. I got that diaper money, dude. I got that diaper money. I'm a grown-ass man.
Jay Morgan. I got that white.
And we'll go right back to the phones, your questions, comments for Alvaro Vargas Llosa on his new book. It's titled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. Now to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I totally agree with the idea of a three-generational timeline assimilation, but with the fast pace of global events and ethnic disputes that exist around the world, blown up by the media, there seems to be less effect of an Americanizing impact or moderation in the first generation. And an example would be the outcry of Sharia law that has come up.
Well, I appreciate Steve calling in. I mean, the issue of Sharia law has really not come up in the United States. It's come up in Europe, for instance. There are pockets of immigrants from Muslim countries who are embracing and espousing those ideas and values, but they're very, very small. There are only a tiny percentage of the Muslim immigrant community in Europe, and there's been a backlash against that by the immigrants themselves in France, in Spain, in other parts of in the United States. It really hasn't been the case. One of the wonderful things about Muslim immigrants in the United States, and just the Muslim community in general, not necessarily immigrants, is that it was never the case that radicalism, that fanaticism took root in the way that it did in small pockets of the immigrant community in Europe. So there's a big contrast there.
But broaden that question to other forms of religion, other types of ethnicity.
Oh, this is a very interesting aspect of this. It's part of the cultural conversation about immigration. My research indicates that in the last, let's take the last 20 years, about 70% of immigrants of Hispanic origin, obviously in the case of Asian immigrants, this varies, were or are Catholic, and about 23 to 25% are or were Protestant. But of those Catholic immigrants that I mentioned, one-fifth describe themselves as born again, which is something that you don't see throughout Latin America, the countries where they're coming from, which really is a form of acculturation and assimilation again, because they what they're saying is, I still want to be Catholic, I don't necessarily want to be Protestant, but I am born again. In other words, I have this connection with the Protestant majority, if you will, in the United States. So this is another bridge between immigrants and U.S. society, because not only, of course, is Catholicism very large in the United States anyway, but also because there's a connection between Protestants and Catholics that they're expressing in this particular manner.
And here's a question from Joseph in Louisville, Kentucky, all about economics. He says, what about the fact that massive illegal immigration from Latin America began only after the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement that drove many Mexican farmers off their land? Corn prices in Mexico were undercut by subsidized corn prices produced by American agribusiness. He says, first we create the problem and then we blame the victims.
Well, first of all, the big influx of Mexican and other Northern American, if you want, immigrants in the United States did not begin in the 90s. It really began in after 65, when there was a new law that was passed that really kind of changed very much the approach to immigration in terms of the law. But yes, in the 1990s, there was a big influx, mostly because the economy was booming back then and there was a huge demand. Now, the effect of the free trade agreement on the Mexican economy, and this is a different topic and we could take a long time to talk about this, but essentially what happened is the Mexican economy began to modernize itself. So what you saw is exactly the same process that you saw in this country many decades ago. In other words, a lot of people moving from agriculture to industry. And because of specialization, there was no need anymore to have millions and millions of people doing agricultural work, because it was easier to import agricultural goods and food in general, and those people found work in industry. And today Mexico is doing much better than it was 20 years ago, so much so, Diane, that I anticipate a time when we will be, from this country, we'll be
asking,
talking about where do we get new immigrants from, because the
exactly.
Mexicans don't need to come anymore.
Now, here's another email with a different perspective. He says, I've been a Border Patrol agent for 10 years now. With the abundance of social support programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare, there is a reduced incentive to work hard once those benefits become available. He goes on to say, I am all for the legal immigration of educated, skilled workers, but am fearful of the burden that 11 million illegally immigrated people will put on the already taxed social support system.
Oh, that Border Patrol touches on a really important topic. I think he's right. I mean, of course, a lot of benefits, or let's say an excess of benefits in any society, will generate those incentives. But that will be exactly the same for native citizens. I mean, these incentives work exactly the same way, with one difference, perhaps, and it's this: it's the average age. I think we need to take that into account when we're talking about what you take out of the system, what you contribute to the system. The average age for immigrants is 27, which means they're young and they're going to be working for a long period of time after they become legal, if they become legal. The average American is, I guess, 42 the last time I looked at the figures. So in that sense, they will contribute more to the system. And also in terms of what they take out of the system, say Social Security, this is a very interesting topic as well. About 1.3% of immigrants are over 65, unlike in the case of natives, where it's about 12%. So again, a lot more workers contributing to the system, and a lot fewer people, in this case, elderly people, taking out of
right,
the system.
To Conroe, Texas. Good morning, Edgar.
I had a question, Ms. Freeman. Actually, I got a comment.
Sure.
I'm a construction worker. I've been my whole life. They really ain't taking our jobs. What the problem is finding skilled people that are willing to work hard for their money. And then the question that I had is, majority of your white people probably think about the integration and stuff is how we treated the Native Americans ourselves over the years, and how we I'm trying to put it as a nice way, how we pretty much put them out while we came in early case.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Well, I think we're talking about two very different things. And I also want to clarify, when I personally talk about natives, I'm not talking about Native Americans. I'm talking about people who are native to the United States, by contrast to immigrants who come from overseas, of course. But he talked about construction. I mean, clearly that's one of the industries where you've seen a lot of low-skill immigrants in the past. And what my research found was that there were fewer and fewer, which doesn't mean zero, but there were fewer and fewer natives. In other words, Americans, people born in the United States, who wanted to take those jobs. So there was clearly demand for low-skilled immigrant workers there, which is why that was one of the industries where they tended to go towards, to concentrate in. Why? Well, probably because in those particular industries, Americans were willing to move up the scale. So what tended to happen was immigrants would come in, take those jobs, Americans would move up the scale to perhaps managerial positions. A lot of managerial positions were created in the last 20 years in that industry in particular, and other industries where immigrants came in. So what you saw was this dynamic. People come in, take the lower jobs, other people move up, and that's always been the case, except that now immigrants are part of that deal.
All right, to Orlando, Florida. I think Jeff has also a question regarding Native Americans. Go right ahead, sir.
Thank you. I just kind of wanted to make the observation that I think it's tragically comic that there's a large segment of the white population that are the beneficiaries of quite a big tragedy in the Native American Holocaust, and to have them turn around and decry, you know, other people coming into the country at this point is just kind of ludicrous.
Well, I respect those sentiments. I wouldn't put it quite that way. I think that, yes, I mean, that historical wound is very much there. But that's not a reason why we shouldn't contemplate the future in a more constructive way. I mean, if anything, we should learn from that past.
And to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Brian.
Oh, hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a big fan of the Independent Institute, and I'm glad to hear Mr. Vargas Llosa. And I had a question about what he was talking about, the arc of assimilation, first, second, third generation. Now, how much, when you talk about the third generation, we're talking about three generations ago with that started. Over time, like you mentioned in the 60s, how the attitudes toward multiculturalism and assimilation changed. when you go back three generations, we're talking about the Woodrow Wilson administration. And you know, back then, they didn't have press one for English, press two for German. In a lot of ways, even expressing any kind of German identity was pretty much outlawed by the Wilson administration. So there was a greater force for assimilation. How relevant is your third generation data, historical data, now? And I guess that's my question. I mean, how relevant is that data now? Because I know people, first generation immigrants, whose parents, they immigrated here, first generation Americans. When they were growing up, they were told not to speak English in the home. They were forbidden from speaking English in the home. They had to speak Spanish. And I think attitudes have changed a lot since three generations ago. How will that affect three generations from now?
Well, the law changed in 1965, so it's almost half a century now. And so that's plenty of time to see whether the new situation differs very much from the previous situation, because we've had several generations after that. And today it is still the case, very much the case, that it's a three-generation pattern. What happens, again, is the first generation makes progress, the second generation is bilingual and is substantially assimilated, and the third generation is completely assimilated, and so much so that they forget the mother tongue. You also have a very interesting situation, which is they feel so secure, just as the Irish did and the Italians did in the past, so secure about being part of the society that they begin to claim their heritage in terms of festivities and these kinds of things. Of course, nothing very substantial in the sense that they're not going to become un-American. It's simply that they feel so secure, so assimilated, then they don't feel they're going to be looked upon or frowned upon if they begin to embrace certain holidays and certain festivities back home.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Sam, who says, I live in the greater Grand Rapids, Michigan metro area. There's a large Hispanic population here. I've noticed hundreds of small businesses have popped up in these Hispanic areas. They seem to only hire other Hispanic immigrants. I don't see how this helps anybody who was born here in the U.S. and is now jobless due to the recession.
Good point. Two things, Diane. One is entrepreneurship among immigrants is very much a driving force. The percentage of immigrants that are self-employed because they want to create their own businesses and not work for somebody else is very much the same as for the native population, for Americans. It's between 12 and 13%. So again, that's another way of showing how culturally compatible immigrants are with native society. And yes, of course, in certain communities, it's going to be almost inevitable that people hire other people who speak their language. But believe me, they will never go against their economic interests. If they have to pick, between just being just expressing solidarity with another fellow immigrant or just being profitable. I mean, they're going to choose being profitable. Which is the way the economy works. It just may be that in that particular community, there's a disproportionate number of immigrants, so they will tend to hire other immigrants. Probably.
And here's a final email. People claim immigrants, legal or illegal, take work away from Americans. This could be true. But in 1959, he says, I took a summer job as a carpenter's helper at $1.75 an hour. I could work 3 hours and after taxes had enough to fill my car with gas. Try that today with minimum wage. There are few, if any, Americans who'd be willing to do that. You know, throughout this discussion, it seems to me that there is an undercurrent of fear that we haven't touched on, fear of the unknown, fear of change, fear of how any group of immigrants large enough is going to change what we Americans believe we own.
No question, Diane. I think you make a really important point. Sometimes when I speak to people who make some of these arguments against immigration, I feel that they're not really believing in those arguments so much as trying to rationalize what is really a very deep-seated fear, which is very human. It's understandable. It's happened in almost every community through history. I've seen it in my own country. I was telling one of your producers the other day how interesting it was. In my father was involved in politics a long, long time ago.
Ran for president.
That's right, in 1990. And I remember racism and ethnicity becoming a huge issue in that campaign on two different levels. One was because we were accused of being Spanish descendants or descendants from Spain. So that was kind of somehow, you know, something that made us unelectable. But we also had people on our side who, because one of my father's rivals was a man of Japanese descent, people on our side saying, how could we vote for somebody who's Asian of Asian descent? And I can remember feeling what's happening here is simply fear. That's what it is. And we need to put those fears to rest.
Javro Vargas Llosa. His new book is titled Global Crossings, Immigration, Civilization, and America. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, it's been an honor for me, Diane.
And
thank you so much.
And give my best to your dad.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from members